Welcome to Growing Your Wealth with Brian Evans and Jeff Shade, a show that simplifies the complexities of investments, taxes, retirement, and more so you can discover how to better sustain yourself and your wealth for years to come. Brian is a CPA with 30 years experience and a financial advisor, which brings a unique perspective to the financial world. This show is brought to you by Madrona Financial and CPAs, home of the Rooted Wealth Plan. Want a retirement plan designed to last 30 plus years? Go to MadronaFinancial.com and click Get Started to see what the Rooted Wealth Plan can do for you. And now, here are your hosts, Brian Evans and Jeff Shade.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Growing Your Wealth with Brian Evans, the show that gives you the straight talk and honest answers you need to help sustain yourself and your wealth for 30 plus years. On today's show, we're going to be talking about how the private markets can play an important role in your portfolio. Also, how to prepare for your future healthcare needs. My name is Jeff Shade, and as always, as you know, I'm just here to ask the questions. But of course, the words of wisdom, solid advice, they come from Brian Evans, CEO and President of Madrona Financial and CPAs. Hey, Brian, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jeff.
Always glad to hear that. Our listeners are doing well today, too. Brian, I read an interesting claim the other day that suggested that more and more businesses are raising capital through the private markets as opposed to the old traditional stock market through an IPO. What is your take on this?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. And you mentioned IPO, too. That's interesting because we think about companies that we can invest in. And a lot of people don't understand the primary and secondary markets and then the public versus private markets. So spend a minute on that. But basically, when a company wants to raise capital and maybe the founders want some money and want to be able to trade some of their shares, they will do what's called an IPO, initial public offering. And so I think it was back in the early 80s that Microsoft, for instance, did theirs so that Bill Gates and Paul Allen could get some money, get some cash, be able to sell small portions of shares. Because when you own all of a company like that, people either want to buy the whole thing or none at all. So they go with the IPO, the initial public offering. Well, that's where Microsoft comes into cash, the company itself. And what people don't understand sometimes is then from then on, we're dealing in the secondary market primarily. So meaning the shares have been issued, sold, authorized, issued, and they're out there. And so then when you buy shares of, say, Microsoft in this case, I talk to people all the time and they think, okay, I just bought $10,000 from Microsoft. I hope they do good with that money. I'm like, well, none of that went to Microsoft. I always use Mrs. Nussbaum in Tallahassee is my, my go-to on this one.
Right.
You bought it from her. You bought it from somebody that's selling on the secondary market, a retail investor, not the company itself, because it's on the secondary market now. Sometimes I have that discussion with people that, well, I don't want to invest in that company. I don't like what they're doing. I'm saying, well, you're not really investing in the company now that it's on the secondary market. You're just trading with somebody else. And so it's not really a company thing. And so that's the public markets. So that's kind of how they go. But then we have this thing called private markets. And that's where they have not gone through an IPO stage. They have not done an initial public offering. They're not offering their shares for sale to the general public. And you think, well, gee, there can't be a lot of those companies. Well, the statistics on that is larger companies, those companies over $100 million of annual revenue, only 12% are publicly traded. 88% are private. And you don't have access to them, essentially. And so I verified that number because that's from Blackstone. And I went online to try and verify that. And sure enough, it did show that there was 2,800 publicly traded companies with more than 100 million. So if you buy the Russell 2000 or something, or the, let's say, a total market index, you'll probably get a representative mix of that 2,800 companies. But then there are another 18,000 companies with over 100 million in annual revenue that are private, that are not listed on the stock exchange. You can't just go out and buy shares of stock in. They're privately held. And so that's an interesting nuance that we think that if we're buying the, let's say, the total market index or the S&P 500 or something like that, that we're buying all the companies, all the major companies in the U.S. No, you're buying a representative sample of 12% is all of larger companies.
Brian, how does private market investing differ from, let's say, venture capital investing? Or is it the same thing?
Well, yeah, no, that is a form of private investing. So what happens is we have all these 18,000 private companies out there. Well, they're not permanent. You know, companies are not in business forever with the same ownership. The founders, you know, one of the common themes of any founder of any private business is that they want a liquidity event someday. They want to be cashed out. They want to retire. They want to sell. They get older. You know, companies are founded by people, and people get older. And so right now we're seeing an incredible wave of private businesses. And now I'm talking about businesses under $100 million in sales, but a huge wave because most businesses were founded and operated by the demographic that I'm going to say is the baby boomers. They're between about the ages of early 60s to the late 70s. So that's, you know, you think about that. Oh, so the average baby boomer, I'm going to guess, is probably 68, 69 years old if you just did the midpoint. And you think, oh, 68, 69, that sounds like retirement age unless you're an elected official or running for president.
Right.
But for the rest of us, late 60s is often considered an average retirement age.
Right.
And so you've got this massive amount of businesses because most businesses are not owned by 25-year-olds or 35-year-olds or 45. They're owned by 65, 75-year-olds. And so they're looking for a liquidity event. Now, sometimes they're going to pass it family along family lines, but even anymore, a lot of businesses are not being passed down along family lines because kids want to do something else. They have different options. Maybe they're into technology and so forth, and they don't want to take over dad's pest control business or farming business or whatever it was. They want to do something completely different. And sometimes, you know, you have kids, you go, well, do I really want to turn my business over to them and count on them to pay me monthly for the rest of my life? Gosh, I can't even get them to show up at Thanksgiving on time. You know, I'm not going to put my entire business in their hands and hope for the best. I'm going to sell to somebody that's got the funding. And so a lot of businesses are selling that weren't selling in prior years. We're working with more and more people that are selling businesses, business succession planning, we call it. In fact, I'm starting to work on a webinar series with a business broker on this very topic about the nuances of business succession. But one of the common themes is that, okay, we got to sell this business. Well, who do I sell my farm or pest control business or whatever it is? Who do I sell that to? I could sell it to a competitor, but they probably can't cash me out. They don't, you know, they're just working hard. They don't have millions and millions and millions of dollars to pay for a business. So where do you go? You go to venture capital companies. You go to private equity, one and the same essentially. And so these are companies that have accumulated great sums of investment money, liquidity, and they can go in and write that $5 million, $10 million, $15, $50 million check to buy a business, and then they will take that business. I was talking to somebody, in fact, a business broker about this, and here was a typical way they would do that. So they would go out and say, all right, we're going to consolidate businesses in a particular field. And so they would do 50% leverage. So let's say that they had $25 million. They would go out and buy $50 million of businesses and borrow from the bank. And we're going to talk about borrowing from the bank in a minute. Borrow from the bank at a very low interest rate because the interest rates, you know, they could borrow at 2-4% a couple of years ago. And so they leveraged their $25 million into 50. And once they bought about 10 businesses, just by the sheer size, that changes the dynamic of valuations. It basically doubled, often doubled the value of these businesses because they were a bigger entity and they could sell that group for more than the sum of the individual components. So now they put $25 million down, they borrowed $25 million, they've consolidated, let's say, 10 businesses. Those 10 businesses are now not worth $50 million, they're worth $100 million. So without even doing any operational changes to improve profitability, they were able to to take a $25 million investment and create $50 million of gain. That's a 200% return before you've even started to work on the businesses themselves through improvements in scale and efficiencies and so forth. So you think about that, it's like, wow, I could see why the rich get richer. Essentially, private equity is out there doing that. And a few years ago was a heyday for that. There was cheap money available that people could leverage. There was a lot of cash chasing the deals and a lot of consolidation going on and buying and selling of businesses. Well, that really slowed down quite a bit with the rise in interest rates. It hasn't stopped by any stretch. There's just less leverage now. Your companies aren't going to just borrow to buy like they used to because they're paying too much in interest. But you know, it's still going on. But there's just kind of a taste of the world of private equity, venture capital. It's cash, you know, not going into the stock market, not going into the bond market, but actually going into small businesses and then consolidating them, grouping them together, and then creating operational efficiencies, maybe better management, better computer systems, better, you know, everything. Certainly bigger companies with more resources can do improvements to small businesses.
Brian, our conversation here has me a bit intrigued about investing in private equity. Who has a seat at this table? In other words, how do I know if I'm qualified?
Well, I can tell you that if you're doing your own investing on your own, you don't have a seat at the table because you have to go through investment advisors or brokers. You have to go through licensed financial professionals to access private markets, whether that be the private equity market I was just talking about, businesses. It could be private non-traded real estate, private credit funds that replace banks, and we'll talk about that in a second, private lending, that kind of thing, private projects, development funds, all this kind of stuff. You have to go through a financial professional. You just can't do it on your own. And then I also want to add that even if you go through a financial professional, depending on what you're investing in, you're going to have different qualification standards of your net worth, your investable assets, that kind of thing. All of these things I'm talking about generally have some kind of minimum to be able to qualify to even buy them through a financial professional. So again, if you're a do-it-yourself investor and that's all you want to do, you're not going to be able to have access to anything we're talking about here.
Brian, I think based on our conversation today, our listeners may have some questions about investing in private equity. And if that is you, I want you to consider this. You know, if you're looking to improve your home, would you rather go to a lumber store where they just have one thing? Or would you rather go to a big store where maybe they have many, many different solutions to your problem? Same way with financial services and same way with investing in products like private equity. If you're looking for opportunities, if you're looking for a relationship which is more of a consulting relationship, than a sales pitch, then you want to be in touch with us here at Madrona Financial and ask for your complimentary Madrona analysis. Now, to get yours, call 833-673-7373. You can do it right now. We have opened the phone lines for you. It's just a basic conversation between you and an advisor here at Madrona Financial to answer the questions that you may have, not only about private equity, but all the other aspects of your portfolio and your journey towards a confident retirement. Once again, the phone lines are open right now. Why don't you call it and set up your appointment today? Once again, that number, 833-673-7373. Now, you must have at least $500,000 or more of investable assets to qualify, but if you do, we'll send you out Brian's book, 7 Steps to a Successful Retirement. Once again, take advantage of this opportunity to call 833-673-7373 and request your Madrona analysis. Again, it's not going to cost you a dime, and this one call could make all the difference. Brian, earlier you talked about secondary markets. What are some of the detriments that we need to understand about private equity?
Yeah, there are detriments to every investment, as we always say on this show. So, you know, why are there minimums? Why can't anybody invest in private equity? Well, risk. There can be higher risk with private equity over, say, buying a S&P 500, which is 500 publicly traded companies. Private equity, you know, maybe you're buying a smaller pool of assets. So you have higher risk. And then you go, okay, well, why would you do that then if I have higher risk? Well, obviously, you probably have higher potential return. That is why people invest invest in private equity. You know, you get all these folks pooling money and going out and buying these companies. That's hard to do. Why don't they just go out and buy the S&P 500 or the Russell 2000? Well, because they think they can make more money buying individual companies, pulling them together, and improving their operations. They see a higher upside. That is why they'd buy private equity. We'll talk about private debt. I've been teasing here for a second, but because you can get higher returns. That's what they're trying to go for. But on the negative side, you take higher risk, and you might be buying into something that's illiquid. You can't just convert it to cash. You can't buy somebody's business on Tuesday and start selling it off in pieces on Thursday. You know, that's just not how it works. So liquidity, if you need liquidity and you need to be very tolerant of risk, this probably isn't for you. But this is for people with higher net worths that want diversification and potentially higher returns that aren't just focused on reducing risk. They want to grow their assets over having their assets be secure. Remember, there's five things money can do. It can grow, it can be secure, provide cash flow, tax savings, or be liquid. Well, you really can't grow at a high rate and be secure. You got to pick one. And so with a particular investment, you can have both in your portfolio, of course. But these type of investments are more focused on high growth potential, not high security potential or liquidity. They don't do those well. They're higher growth type things. And that is why there are minimums set by often the, you know, I think it's the SEC or whoever, but they set minimums to, and there's all kinds of minimums. Gosh, I was just looking that up, and some have a no minimum. Some have a minimum net worth of $250,000. Some investments like Delaware Statutory Trusts for real estate 1031 exchanges, $1 million of investable assets outside of your principal residence. Some of these private equity funds, they might have a $5 million minimum. I saw $10 million. I saw $30 million when I looked it up. I quit there. I was like, okay, I get the picture here on some companies' offerings, but I know the ones that we offer generally have lower minimums so that we have most of our clients in them. Some things we offer have higher. They might, again, might be accredited investors, $1 million net worth outside your principal residence, or what's called a qualified purchaser, which is a $5 million net worth minimum.
Brian, earlier you talked about investing in debt. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, investing in debt, that sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You think of debt as a bad thing. I'm investing in debt.
It's a four-letter word.
Doesn't sound like a good investment. But no, I mean, there's two sides to every coin. There's two sides to every transaction. There's a borrower and there's a lender. And so I'm talking about being the lender. And so I don't think anybody listening wants to go out and start a bank. So how do you lend money? And anybody that has lent money to family or friends knows that it's a rare day where you actually see return on investment. I always tell my clients, if you lend money to family or friends, this is a gift.
It's a gift.
Okay, just know that it is a gift. I don't care what they tell you. It's a gift. And you'll be one of the very few if you get repaid. So just know that going in. And if you're okay with that, that's fine.
Yeah.
But what interesting statistic on credit investing is in 1994, only 28% of debt that was issued was non-bank debt. So banks are where you went for, you know, 72% of loans were issued by banks. Fast forward to 2000, we've got 54%, so was non-bank lending, so more than half. And 2022, 75% of debt issued was not through a bank. I mean, you think banks, isn't that where everybody goes, businesses go and everything? No. Only 25% of the time does that happen. And businesses, I would think, is even much less than that because of 2008. After 2008, there were a lot of reforms in the lending industry because the banks almost failed. And so private equity had to come out and replace banks as a preferred lender for corporations that are doing big loans, not billion-dollar loans, but, you know, a company wants or a real estate endeavor wants to borrow $50 million, $100 million, $200 million. They don't go to the local bank anymore. Those days are gone. They go to private equity. And so that's where money's being lent. And so why do that? Why don't I just buy the bond market? Bonds are debt. And you know, in fact, the bond market is bigger than the stock market. Isn't that where people invest in debt? You go out and buy a treasury and you get your 3 or 4%, or you buy a corporate bond. Isn't that where you get your money? What, you know, you could. That is a way of investing into debt. But private equity credit funds pay a much, much tend to, I can't talk about any particular product on air, but they tend to pay a much, much higher yield than any bond fund that I've seen. And so that's why people do it. They want access to private markets, private lending, where their cash flow rate of return can be much, much higher than it is in the public markets, which I'll define as the bond market. The bond market, you're not going to see the yields that you see in private credit. And so, well, that sounds great. Shouldn't I take all my money out of bonds and put it into that? Again, positives and negatives to everything. You're taking higher risk. Higher returns generally yield higher risk. And so, you know, you have to learn how to vet these things. You have to know what you're getting into, because if you want those higher, you know, who doesn't want a higher yield? Gosh, count me in. I want higher yield, not lower yield. Of course I do. But what happens if you didn't vet the investments right, and you don't get all of your original investment back?
And to your point about vetting, Brian, I've often heard that to find the needle, you got to pick the right haystack. So how do you pick which opportunities to invest in, and which set of opportunities do you pick them from?
Well, this, you know, this talk, if you've been listening to the show today, you're kind of, maybe your mind's being blown a little bit and going, wait a second. I have an advisor who supposedly has access to all. You just told me, Brian, that I have to go through an advisor to have access to anything you're talking about in this segment of your show. I have a financial advisor, and they have never talked about any of the stuff you're talking about. Well, that's probably correct, because not everybody works. Not all financial advisors are the same. Not all of them work in the other markets. There's six places you can put your money. You can put in cash and cash equivalents, the bond market, the stock market. You can put it into real estate, passive real estate, or active, insurance company products, and alternatives. And a lot of what I'm talking about is the alternative space, private equity, credit funds. Some of it's Delaware statutory trusts or private non-traded equity REITs, real estate investment trusts. So I'd put that in the real estate component. But if your financial advisor doesn't do this stuff, then you know you're not even going to be talking about this other kind of stuff with a potentially much higher returns. The other thing is, even if they offer it and have talked about it, there is a qualitative difference between how you vet these things. Because I'm in the industry. I go to these conferences. I just spoke at a national conference on alternative investments in Dallas just this very week. And I was one of the speakers there, and there are a lot of advisors there. And you know, there's some that really do their homework, and some that are maybe new to this, or some that don't exactly know how to do the homework. They've got to analyze, you know, financial statements and audited reports and really vet this stuff. So we try and do a really good job of that. You know, we're a CPA firm also, so we do understand how to read financial statements. We prepare them for a living. And so the vetting process is huge. You got to know which questions to ask. You need to know the risks. And I was impressed. I was in some of the talks, and people were from the audience. You know, the person would be up there, and they kind of pitch their product, and you know, of course, it's all good. And then, as you know, the smart people like myself and others were, okay, what are the risks? One of the talks was on almond and pistachio farming investing as an alternative investment. Mm. And it sounded awesome. Yeah. And I'm just saying, okay, when are you going to start talking about water rights? Because I don't want, you're in California, you know, that's where they grow most of the world's almonds. Yeah. And all I hear about is that it's a pretty dry state there, and you need a lot of water to grow an almond. So I'm like, okay, let's skip through all the fluffy stuff, get to the good stuff. And then they did. They came out with their grid of California and where the water districts were, and they had it color-coded by basically bad, good, best, you know, that kind of thing, and where they would even think about buying a farm within the Central California region that grows almonds and so forth. So even to that level, you really have to understand, you got to know which questions to ask. You know, what's your coverage ratio? Meaning, you know, okay, yeah, your yield is X, but are you actually earning that in profit, or are you stealing from reserves? Are you taking it out of savings and propping up your cash flow so that we think we're getting more than we are, and that can only last for a short period of time, and then you're going to cut my yield and so forth? What's your coverage ratio? Yeah, these are the kinds of questions we got to do to vet this stuff. So it's one thing, as I mentioned, even know what this stuff is. It's another thing to have access to it through a financial advisor, and it's a whole nother thing for that financial advisor to understand the vetting process so that you can improve your chances of success.
Well, Brian, to your point about the pistachios and almonds, you opened the door for me, so I've got to say, sometimes you feel like a nut, and sometimes you don't. I had to get that one in.
There you go. Yeah, you had that one coming, huh? Yeah,
I had it coming. We're listening to Brian Evans here of Madrona Financial and CPAs, and we've been talking about private market investing. Brian, I want to talk to our listeners right now. If you would like to explore the opportunities that may exist with private equity and private debt, if you're looking to enhance your overall quality of life with your financial portfolio, then listen up because this message is for you. We've opened the phone lines for you right now at Madrona Financial. 833-673-7373 is the number for you to call right now to request your complimentary Madrona analysis. It's just a friendly conversation between you and a Madrona advisor to answer the questions that you may have about private equity and private debt. Again, it's not going to cost you a dime. Now, you must have at least $500,000 or more of investable assets to qualify, but if you do, we'll send you out Brian's book, 7 Steps to a Successful Retirement. Once again, phone lines, they're open right now for you. So what are you waiting for? Make that call, 833-673-7373, and get your questions answered. And remember, this one call could make all the difference. Brian, we're going to take a real quick break. When we come back, we'll be discussing how to prepare for your future health care needs when Growing Your Wealth continues after this.
Big trees fall when storms hit because they don't have deep enough roots. The same goes with your finances. Your quality of life depends on how deep your financial roots are today, tomorrow, and for years to come. If you want to learn how to design your retirement to last 30 plus years, then grab your copy of 7 Steps to a Successful Retirement by calling Madrona Financial and CPAs at 844-MADRONA or go to madronafinancial.com. Now back to more of Growing Your Wealth.
Thanks for joining us here for Growing Your Wealth. If you have missed the first part of the show, you missed a great conversation that we had about investing in private markets. And if you missed that, join us for our podcast. You can get our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on all the major platforms. Simply search for Brian Evans, Growing Your Wealth. You'll find this show that we're doing today, along with all of our past shows, so you can stay on top of your journey towards a confident retirement. My name's Jeff Shade, along with Brian Evans. And in just a moment, Brian and I are going to be discussing how to prepare for your future healthcare needs. But first, we want to invite Dr. Richard Himmer in, one of the partners here at Madrona, to share a few non-financial tips on how to emotionally and mentally prepare for retirement. Richard?
Thank you, Jeff. I want to share a quote from James Clear, the author of the best-selling book Atomic Habits. "The way to live a full life is to act quickly, particularly as you grow older. It's alarmingly easy to let a year or two, or five, slip by without doing the big things you always felt like doing. You get into a rhythm, not necessarily one you love, but one you become comfortable repeating, and the grooves of your daily routine become deeper and more established. Speed is perpetually undervalued. That doesn't mean you should feel frantic or rushed. In fact, it's likely you should eliminate some of the things that make you feel so busy to make space for things you always wanted to do. But it definitely means you should stop letting the days drift by waiting for the moment to be right. Stop acting like there is infinite time. This, the way you are living right now, is your one life." There are 7 steps to the retirement transition. The earlier you start, notice the speed, the higher the probability of a successful experience. Frankly, very few people conduct a successful retake of retirement preparation because they don't know what they don't know, so they try harder instead of different and more deliberately. Today I want to share a pro tip, or more aptly said, a skill set from your second half of life toolkit. Remember, there's 2 halves to life. The first half is kind of the forming, the learning. The second half is supposed to be thriving. It's a bonus half of life that we now call retirement. This is the difference between being irritating and agitating, or an irritant and an adjutant. To irritate means imposing one's own preferences or agenda through criticism or unwanted advice or pressure. Like a rash, it induces discomfort and provokes resistance. Irritants often utilize "you should" statements, stemming from their own goals and paradigms, rather than the individual's needs or values. Examples of this would include high-pressure salespeople, overbearing managers, and even well-intentioned loved ones offering unsolicited direction. Conversely, to agitate means coaching others to accomplish what they, the others, genuinely desire. Consider a washing machine. So through the churning action, it effectively yet gently removes impurities. An agitator applies thoughtful questions and suggestions to spur self-discovery in another person. They seek to elucidate inner wisdom rather than impose external shoulds. As you positively influence people in this bonus stage of life, consider which role you are assuming and which is required for any given relationship. Are you being an unwanted irritant who rubs people the wrong way, or an enlightened agitator who draws out their best? The latter sustains connections that support us across the retirement transition and beyond. When dealing with someone who understands the principle of agitation, they coach, influence, or invite you to do what you want to do. Hence, they agitate the situation to accomplish a desired result. Therefore, if you do what you want to do, you are both better off after the transaction. You know, people hate to be sold, but they love to buy. Now, here's my big warning with exclamation marks. The awareness of this life skill can be frustrating unless you understand the benefits of the process. Learn to embrace agitation. It's a shield against aging. On the other hand, learn to recognize when you are the irritant. Agitating requires specific communication skills. Effective teachers, trainers, coaches, leaders, and parents understand the soft skills necessary to agitate. When processing, shopping, or interviewing for the right financial advisor, make sure you connect with someone who will agitate you to accomplish what you want. Irritants, or those who put you on the annuity assembly line, are selling you something because their only tool is a hammer, so you look like a big fat nail to them. If you want to know more about this, subscribe to our new podcast at HowNotToRetire.com. That's HowNotToRetire.com. You can subscribe. You'll get an e-book complimentary of the process. You can also sign up for Brian's newsletter that comes out weekly. And if you're so inclined, you can experience what it's like to combine wealth and money into a singular process with people who are trained professionals to agitate you within the process. Remember, don't try harder, try different. Until next time, may your habits harmonize with your purpose, leading to a life filled with happiness, joy, and well-being.
Thanks, Richard. Brian, let's dive into our last segment here in the show today, how to prepare for your future healthcare needs. Now, I've heard that the average person is expected to spend around $300,000 in healthcare costs in retirement. Brian, is that figure accurate? Is this true?
Well, I think that's an accurate figure, but like any statistic, gosh, if you're a member of my family history, they spend about $30, I think, in healthcare. Something's wrong with you. You rub some dirt in it. Don't complain.
It.
My parents, grandparents, they just didn't complain. They didn't go to the doctors and mm-hmm. all that. I'm pretty sure that none of them spent $300,000 on healthcare. But certainly when you factor in the possibility of long-term care, that number gets up pretty high, obviously. So some people that don't, if you don't have long-term care, you're probably not going to hit $300,000. If you do, it's likely you might. But yeah, I'll believe that number. You don't believe everything on the internet, but the fact that you asked me about that, I say, yeah, that's probably pretty accurate. So it can be a big number, and that's the bottom line here. Healthcare costs can be a significant number in retirement. Certainly when you're in your working years, your biggest expenses are putting money into your 401k plan, your mortgage, and your kids. In retirement, hopefully you don't have a mortgage. You're not putting money in your 401k plan because you're not working, and your kids hopefully are paying their own bills. But what replaces those? Healthcare costs becomes a primary expense in retirement.
We know what the problem is. Let's talk about some solutions here. I understand that there are some common insurance products that might help people with paying for those costs.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of the different insurance costs. And you know, the other thing that has increased healthcare costs is longevity.
Right.
You know, if you don't live a long time, you're probably not going to spend as much on healthcare. And so back, you know, when they started Social Security during the Roosevelt years, the average life expectancy was in the low 60s. So Social Security started at, whatever, 65, and life expectancy was under 65. So there wasn't, you know, Medicare and all that. That, you know, that wasn't a big drag on the federal government. Well, now everything's changed. I mean, it's a huge drag now. It's a big percentage of the federal government's expenditures. And so because people are, you know, life expectancy is decades longer than it was even during Roosevelt's presidency. And so factor that in, and the cost of all of that becomes a significant aspect to deal with in retirement. So insurance companies, you know, what do insurance company products do? Well, they transfer the risk. We invest in, I've mentioned, you know, there's six places you put your money, invest it. Insurance company products is one of the six. And sometimes, though, insurance company products are oversold by overzealous salespeople. And kind of as a fix it all, you know, the only tool you'll need, you know, you can do any job with this tool. Well, you can't do certain things well with insurance company products. Other things you can, because with any investment, there's pros and cons. And if you're buying security, if you're getting some kind of benefit where you're transferring risk of investments to an insurance company, well, then the flip side of that is you're not going to have as high of a return. You're getting something, but you have to give up something to get something. And so when we think about, for instance, annuities, a lot of annuities, you might hear, oh, gosh, they told me that if I buy this annuity, you know, I mentioned this on the show recently because I heard it on the radio, that you get a 30% bonus and 8% guaranteed return. Well, I just gave you two lies there, Jeff, really, in one sentence. You cannot get a 30% bonus in actual U.S. dollars buying an annuity. You're not going to get 8% guaranteed return on investment in U.S. dollars buying an annuity. That just isn't real. And so what the other thing, though, I hear is it'll cover your long-term care. Well, they can have long-term care riders on annuities, and annuities have their purpose. They can be safe money where you can't lose money. You can get a fixed or an indexed annuity, and the markets go bad, you never lose money. But you can't make as much as the market. Your top side is not as high as other investments. You can have annuities that pay you cash flow for life, guaranteed for life. But understand that cash flow, some of it's earnings and some of it's your own principal. And if you live long enough, that annuity's residual value is zero for your heirs. Maybe that's okay. Maybe that needs to be part of your plan with some of your assets. But, you know, it may not be the plan for all of your assets. And again, I mentioned sometimes annuities are sold with long-term care riders, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But really, it's not a substitute for long-term care. It's not going to pay all of your long-term care. That's not what they're designed to do. They may accelerate some of the benefits from the annuity. I said accelerate, not replace. And so generally annuities that are sold with long-term care riders just accelerate that if you need long-term care so that you can have access to a little bit more money. But in no cases are they designed to, that I've ever seen, are they designed to replace long-term care or cover all of somebody's long-term care.
And Brian, I want to continue this conversation about common insurance products and how they can pay for long-term care. But some people listening to us may say, well, I've got a lot of money. I can self-fund my long-term care or my health insurance needs. Is that always possible or is it ever possible?
It absolutely can be possible. I have a lot of clients that in their financial plan, you know, they've been very successful financially. They have millions and millions of dollars, and they look at the statistics and they go, well, you know, the average stay is X, and gee, I had budgeted maybe $20,000 a month for spending in my retirement because I have lots of money, and if I need long-term care, we figured it's about $20,000 a month for us, and we won't be traveling and doing all the things we would have done with the $20,000. Instead, we'll be giving it to a long-term care facility. And we've already got that budgeted in. So we're going to self-fund. And that's fine. Because generally, if you're in long-term care facility, you are not also traveling and spending the money you plan on spending on other things. It's one or the other. But most people, actually, when it comes to long-term care, a lot of people, you know, we're not talking nursing home. We're talking home care or some assisted living or some level of long-term care. It's usually, there's certainly degrees that we're talking about here. And with each degree, there'll be a difference in your outflow, your expenditure. But I have a lot of clients that decide to self-fund. Some clients, even though they could self-fund, just like the peace of mind of knowing that they have a help help, that they got money coming in for long-term care anyway, especially if they're buying what's called an asset-based long-term care policy, which I'll talk about in a minute.
So let's continue down this path talking about common insurance products, and we've determined that annuities may not be the best answer for you. What about whole life insurance policies?
Yeah, now whole life, there's different kinds of life insurance. There's term life insurance, which is you're renting that insurance policy for the term of the policy itself. Mm-hmm. It runs out. It has a term, a period of time, and it runs out. So that's term insurance. The other insurances are what's called permanent insurance. Permanent insurance has an investment component to it, so it doesn't run out. It's designed to keep that insurance going even into your older years if you live a long time. But you're giving something up for that. So built into these policies, you don't get anything for nothing in the investment world. So a lot of your money might be going to the insurance part of that, the part that would pay your beneficiaries if you pass away. And so if you just want an investment that goes up in value, probably don't go through an insurance company to do it. But some people need insurance coverage. Most of us probably need life insurance for various reasons. And so if you have life insurance, you don't want it to go away when you get older. That's the point of it. You want it there. So you buy a permanent insurance policy. Whole life is one of those. That used to be the one that was sold decades ago, pretty much across the board. You had whole life, you had variable life, which is kind of in the market too. So you have an investment component there. Whole life is, it was more of a kind of a design to have a lower steady return. Problem I found with whole life has been, in many cases, the return isn't enough to really do much for you on the investment side of things, and it really becomes just a more of a permanent life insurance policy without much of an investment component. Universal life came along, and that allows for gains, market type gains, with limitations on downside risk and so forth. So we work in that space, primarily universal life, and we kind of use it for a couple purposes. One is to have life insurance your whole life. You know, it doesn't run out. And the other is to use it as an investment, whether it's for an estate planning purpose. We use it for that. We also use it to provide a lifetime cash flow that's tax-free. So in my case, I mentioned annuities earlier, and there is a place for annuities. They're especially good for lowering risk of investment and guaranteed lifetime cash flow. I personally don't own an annuity because I'm a risk taker. I own a business. I have 35 employees. Mm-hmm. I like to take risks with my investments. I like to be diversified in my investing. I like to grow my portfolio. I don't need security. Some people, like my brother, need security. He bought an annuity from me. You know, it's mm-hmm. they're not for everybody. And I personally have a universal life policy because that's out of my control. I could pass away. I want to take care of people in my life. So I bought that for insurance coverage. I also like the idea, if I live long enough, which I hope to do, that I can draw cash flow out of that income tax free. I think I'm going to be in a high bracket someday. So that was a good fit for me. The other one wasn't. But I'll put clients into things that aren't a good fit for me, obviously, and vice versa. So depending on what you're looking for, we mentioned, whole life has some investment component, but it's not necessarily as active as maybe a universal life policy. But that's something we can illustrate for people, take a look at it. It's not really designed, again, for long-term care, though. Again, when we're talking about different insurances, annuities, they may say long-term care in them. They're not going to cover all of your long-term care needs. Life insurance typically is not designed as a long-term care type policy.
Brian, this is a lot of information to digest. I'm not sure if I completely understand it, and I think our listeners may have some questions too. So how do our listeners figure all this out? Who do they go to for answers?
Right, Jeff. Yeah, I have covered a lot. There's no perfect solution, but there is a solution that best suits you. So maybe it's a combination of different things I'm talking about. I mentioned I might invest very differently for me than I would for my brother. And got to work with someone who's independent and can help you explore what's best for you. And that's what we do here. So we go through processes, you know, where we ask you questions, we find out about you to figure out what's appropriate. So you don't have to come in here and say, well, I think I need X, Y, and Z that I heard on the radio. No, that's not how this works. We're going to find out about you. And then, you know, we're held to the fiduciary standard. But beyond that, we're also CPAs. And we have access to all the different, you know, virtually every product out there that a financial advisor has access to. So we're going to find out the right fits for you. We'll tell you when things aren't appropriate, when they are. You don't have to come in here and tell us what you need. We'll discover that together.
Well, Brian, I think based on a conversation here today, I'm pretty sure that our listeners may have some questions about long-term care, so if that is you, listen up because this might be applicable to your situation. I want you to call 833-673-7373 right now. I know it may be the weekend, but we've opened the phone lines for you to make that call to request your complimentary Madrona analysis. And once again, that telephone number that you can call right now, 833-673-7373. Again, it's just a conversational analysis between you and a Madrona advisor to find out what your healthcare needs may be and to answer your specific questions. Now, remember, you've got to have at least $500,000 or more of investable assets to qualify. However, if you do, we'll send you out Brian's book, 7 Steps to a Successful Retirement. Again, it's 833-673-7373. No cost, no obligation for this. It is not going to cost you a dime. But remember this one call. It really could make all the difference as far as answering your questions about long-term care and how to pay for health care. Brian, I've heard these horror stories about long-term care insurance policies. I mean, the premiums get higher and higher. People can't afford them. Sometimes the insurance policies are even canceled. What's going on here with long-term care insurance policies?
Yeah, that is a big problem. And we're talking about traditional long-term care right now, where you pay this monthly amount as opposed to asset-based long-term care. So with traditional long-term care, these policies maybe you bought them decades ago and so forth. And essentially, the industry priced it wrong. They did not anticipate the decades and decades of high inflation within health insurance costs and the massive increase in life expectancy and longevity. And so they were priced wrong, and the companies were not able to fulfill their obligations without dramatically increasing. So you might have gotten an illustration 30 years ago when you bought it, and you weren't spending very much money on it. And now you're older, and that company say, well, the only way we can support this long-term care policy is to jack your rates. And you're going, wait a second, I saved up, I bought this long-term care policy, I wanted to have a good retirement, and now my travel budget is going just to cover my traditional long-term care coverage. I don't even get to do the things I want to do because that got jacked up. And so that is a real thing. So I'm not a, it's basically not sold anymore, hardly at all, traditional long-term care. It's been replaced with asset-based long-term care. We actually come up with a chunk of money up front. And then what's cool about the asset-based long-term care is that it can provide, long-term care benefits depending on how much you put in and so forth. It can have inflationary riders built onto it. And if you don't use it, many of these policies will refund a significant portion of your original investment back to your heirs upon your passing. And so you're not out all that money like you are with traditional long-term care. So when we do place somebody in a long-term care policy, we would use what's called an asset-based long-term care.
So, Brian, asset-based long-term care, it sounds interesting. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that and how someone may determine whether or not they could even do that?
Yeah, so with asset-based long-term care, when we do your financial plan, we take a look at it and we say, okay, we don't know if you're going to need long-term care, or if both of you, if you're married, might need it. But if we want to provide something for that, we can run that illustration. So let's say you put a chunk of money, let's give a number to it. Let's say you put $100,000 into one of these policies. That is not going to cover all of your long-term care needs, but it can take a big dent out of it. And so depending on your health, you do have to physically qualify for these things in your age. They will illustrate a certain coverage for that. And you say, well, Brian, I thought, you just told me it's not going to cover it. Well, maybe with your Social Security, your pensions, your REIT distributions, your interest, dividend distributions, and so forth, you have a particular amount of cash flow coming in, but it's not enough to cover a full-on long-term care facility if you need it. So you might just need this as a supplement. So you put in enough money to supplement based upon the financial plan we run for you. And then again, if you need it, you can use it. It usually delivers a multiple of what you put in. So we'll call that X. You'll get some kind of multiple on how much money you put in. If you want twice as much, you put in twice as, instead of 100 grand, you put 200 grand in, whatever the case may be. But we can take a look and see what kind of supplement of cash flow you would need and what policy would cover that. And again, as I mentioned, the best thing about these things, well, not the best thing, the best thing is it can give you supplement your cash flow when you need long-term care. But if you don't need the long-term care, you never use the policy, money can go to your heirs from the policy. It's not just lost to the insurance company. So it can be a kind of a feel-good investment, just another something to do, part of the security, which is the 7 steps to successful retirement. helps add to some level of security that you know that you have a supplement built into your financial plan, and you didn't have to rock the bank. You didn't have to spend all your travel budget in retirement or whatever the case may be. You come up with a sum of money once, you put it in there, you don't think about it anymore. They don't send you monthly bills after that.
Okay, Brian, I'm 65 and I've got Medicare. Why can't I just use Medicare to pay for long-term care or healthcare needs like that?
Well, promise me you won't be in the hospital for more than 100 days. And I say, well, then that's okay. But Medicare is not designed for long-term care. And so it covers a little bit, a little short-term stays, but that's it. It is not designed for long-term care. So we need to supplement outside of Medicare for long-term care. Now, if you are of low income, low assets, your long-term care plan, maybe you're sitting there going, well, I don't have assets to invest. I can't do $100,000 or $200,000, anything like that. What am I going to do for long-term care? Well, that's when Medicaid kicks in. Mm-hmm. So you're basically required to kind of give up your assets. But if you don't have a lot, then that is your long-term care plan would probably be Medicaid. And that's, but I didn't say Medicare, did I?
No.
So for those of us that want to leave assets to our kids or our spouse or whatever, don't rely on Medicare. That's not what it's designed for. We have to do our own. So, you know, we think, oh, gosh, I'm fine. I've turned 65. I'm on Medicare. I got a Medicare supplement. I pay into that. I'm good. My health care is covered. Well, not your long-term care. So we got one piece left of the puzzle that we have to still solve for. When we do your financial plan for you here, if you come in and have us do that for you, then that is something that we will need to solve for. We need to look at what your cash flow needs will be later in life, what your assets will be. Our plan will do that. It'll estimate your assets, net of taxes along the way with inflation and earnings built in and spending and everything. We try and get everything, a very comprehensive report. But that will help give us a lot of good information so we can answer the question as to, do you need supplemental long-term care asset-based plan? Can you self-insure? Do you not need it? Can you afford it? Can you not afford it? Where would that money come from? Is it going to adversely affect your retirement? These are the questions that we will answer for you. You don't have to come in with these answers. It's pretty easy on your end. You fill out a questionnaire on your investments and so forth and lifestyle choices. We work with you, get to know you, and do the financial plan to make these determinations.
Brian, we've talked about annuities, whole life insurance policies, universal life, traditional long-term care, and asset-based long-term care. What would you say is the best long-term care policy?
Well, that's one of our steps, the lifestyle plan. And most people's lifestyle plan, what do you want your life to look like, includes being healthier and exercising more. That is a common theme. Maybe, you know, you're raising kids, you're working all these hours, you're tired when you get home. And a lot of people in retirement, that they have more time on their hands. They have the ability to exercise more. And so that's obviously the best long-term care plan is take care of yourself, eat right, get your exercise, make sure you're getting your physicals, you're going to the doctor often to make sure that you're okay and they catch things early as they come up. So that can be a good thing. Conversely, if you don't take care of yourself, you know, we're talking about how longevity has added greatly to medical expenses. You might have a lot of medical expenses. They might not last as many years because you wouldn't live as long if you don't take care of yourself. But generally, people we're working with are pretty good about wanting to live the life they want to live. I mean, we talk about that on the show all the time. That's what we do is all about. It's not about selling you an annuity. It's not about putting you in a stock bond split. It's about helping you live the life you want to live.
Brian, this has been a great conversation today, but unfortunately, Brian, we're out of time for this week. I want to thank you for your time, but most of all, I want to thank our listeners for joining us. For Brian Evans, I'm Jeff Shade. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll talk to you again next week right here with another edition of Growing Your Wealth. Have a great weekend.
No statements made during the Growing Your Wealth show should constitute tax, legal, or accounting advice. You should consult your own legal or tax professional on your own individual information. Brian Evans and Madrona Financial Services is licensed to offer investment advisory services through Madrona Financial Services, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Insurance products are offered through Madrona Insurance Services, LLC, a licensed insurance agency and an affiliate of Madrona Financial Services. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Investors cannot invest directly into indexes. No investment strategy, including asset allocation and diversification, information guarantees a profit or guarantees the avoidance of loss. Financial planning is an important tool that does not guarantee specific outcomes. DSD investments are only available to accredited investors and offered solely through the issuer's offering documents. The DST sponsor determines whether to accept any individual subscription documents. Madrona Financial and CPAs is a registered trade name used singly and collectively for the affiliate entities. Madrona Financial Services, LLC, Madrona, and Bauer Evans, Inc., PC. Bauer Evans. Investment advisory services are provided through Madrona. CPA services are provided through Bauer Evans.